WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Farrelly brothers' jokes are cheap, adolescent, and crude, and they get the whole country laughing. Peter and Bobby Farrelly wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. In There's Something About Mary, Ben Stiller starred as a nerd who since high school has been obsessed with pretty and perky Mary. Ready to confess his love, Stiller hires a private detective, played by Matt Dillon, to track her down. But the detective falls in love with Mary and wants her for himself, so in his report to Stiller, he lies and creates a very unappealing portrait of Mary.
Got some excellent news for you, my friend.
Oh, yeah? Excellent?
I think your life's about to change.
Really? So you found her?
Oh, yeah. You were right, man. She really is something else.
Oh, my God. Really? So she hasn't changed at all, huh?
Well, that I couldn't say. Let me ask you something. Was Mary a little big boned back in high school?
Big boned? No, not at all. No.
I guess she packed on a few pounds over the years.
Oh yeah, so she's a little chubby?
Oh, I'd say about a deuce and a half. Not bad.
Oh, my, a deuce and a half.
Huh. You know, a bunch of kids, and you're bound to put on a few pounds.
Oh, so she's married?
No, she's never been. That's the good news.
Huh?
Yeah. Four kids, three different guys, but no rock. Tough to keep up with in a wheelchair, I bet.
Oh, she's in a wheelchair? Mary's in a wheelchair?
We recorded the Farrelly brothers talking about their movies at the New York Comedy Film Festival in October. They were interviewed on stage by their old friend Michael Corenti, who directed Federal Hill and is directing a movie written by Bobby Farrelly called Outside Providence.
I guess the first question is, everybody's dying to know, is were you guys just regular knuckleheads as kids? Did comedy just happen, or were you like the class clowns in school, or?
Well, we were special.
You were special?
Yeah. I guess. No. Actually, we were very, very normal kids. We were both you know, poor students, and, you know, we played sports and, you know, just fooled around, that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until our mid-20s that we got the bug to write, and it was, I don't know where the bug came from. We were not kids that watched a lot of movies. We didn't have a movie theater in our town except for 2 years. And we weren't, you know, running around with the Super 8s, and, you know, we were just normal people who went to movies, and we walked out a lot of times and thought, that just sucked, you know? I mean, why didn't they do this or that? We'd sit around and talk about it with our sisters or, you know, friends. Like, do you see that, you know, the ending? Don't you think it would have been better if this happened? And finally, in our mid-20s, just sort of having failed in a lot of different departments, and, you know, school and jobs and this type of thing, we thought, let's just try that. You know, what the hell?
How about your inspirations, your filmmakers that have inspired you guys?
We didn't really grow up watching movies. Don't know, and like even to this day, people say, "Oh, geez, you must really be big fans of Preston Sturges or Billy Wilder." I don't even know their movies. You know, like which ones they are. I really don't.
Wow.
We didn't study any of them. If anything, we grew up watching the Three Stooges on television, but mainly just what made us laugh in real life. And we weren't the class clowns. We weren't the guys that were going making up funny stuff, but we'd come home at night at the dinner table and say, "Oh, man, this kid in class today, you know, he tricked this girl. He said, 'Hey, you see the frog? I brought my pet frog with me,' you know, and the girl would look, and he'd pull the head of his hog out of his pants."
Like, which was painted green, by the
way. Yeah, right, painted exactly. Green. Yeah. Like, how's that not funny?
Yeah. That's brilliant, yeah.
We just remembered that kind of stuff and put it in the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody has that kind of stuff. But, you know, a lot we make fun of our ability to direct because, you know, really, you know, we had never directed a commercial video. We hadn't gone to film school before we directed Dumb and Dumber, and it made a lot of money. So we're like, well, it's a scam. You know, I mean, we didn't know anything about directing, literally Nothing, you know? And the thing is, they didn't question it at New Line because we'd written this script, and Jim Carrey read the script, and he said, yeah, I'll make that. And then we had been trying to get movies made for years, and we'd gotten stars attached before, but we couldn't get directors. And then by the time we got the directors, we couldn't get, the star was busy, so it always fallen apart. So at that point, our agent, Richard Lovett, had just said, well, why don't you just say you're directing? We're like, oh, okay. So they said, who's directing? We're like, well, we are. And amazingly, no one questioned this. You know, they just, they were like, okay. So we ended up directing, it worked out.
To this day, we know, to add to that, we know absolutely nothing about lenses. I mean, you don't know what a 30 or 40, 80, whatever the hell numbers they're talking about. You don't know what they are, do you?
No idea.
No idea either. Absolutely do not know. We let them being the director of photography and our technicians on the set it up like you think that we want it. And occasionally we say, yeah, you're wrong. That's not how we want it. It needs to be a little faster or getting closer. It's not, you know, very broad generalizations, but we let the guys on the crew do everything that they do, and we just concentrate on the story and directing the actors into getting a good performance and getting a take and make sure that we feel we're moving on with a good take at every juncture.
Could you talk a little bit about how you guys actually got into it, how your first film got made, what the process was, and where Jim Carrey was? And
well,
it was part of what Pete was saying was that we really wanted to, you know, we just thought we had gone a long time without getting a movie made. We got an actor attached or a director, but we could never get both. And finally, the agent said, attach yourself as directors and just make up your mind you're going to get the movie made. So we picked the script Dumb and Dumber, which we had written and had been, you know, turned down a number of years ago, and said, this is a movie. We can direct this. It's pretty simple. And we just said, you know, made up our mind that we'd probably do it and go right to video. Like, all we wanted to raise was a $500,000, or, you know, if we could raise $1 million, that was a home run. And that's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money to make a movie. Well, anyway, we went and we met with all sorts of people. We met with the Pettis brothers in Washington and everyone in town. And finally, we met with MPCA in L.A. It was this company, straight-to-video company. And they said, all right, we'll give you $1 million to make it. And by the luck of the draw, our agent, Charlie Wessler, got it to Jim Carrey, who was...
Producer Charlie.
Yeah, right, I'm sorry. All right, producer Charlie Wessler got it to Jim Carrey, who was like weeks away from breaking out. And he said, I love this. I want to do it. And right, you know, basically right then, his career started taking off. And in fact, that he was going to do it, New Line came in and said, we'll give you, you know, a little more money. We'll give you, like, you can make it for $3 million or something. Well, Jim Carrey, he had already made Ace Ventura, and he had already made The Mask, but neither one had been released. They were in the can. And he felt like, I've done good work. He felt proud of it. And he said, I want $1 million to make this movie. That was his asking price. He had made $400,000 to make The Mask at New Line, and they own that movie. And they said, no, $1 million? No way. It was right then that Ace Ventura, we went to see Ace Ventura in front of they showed it to us in front of a room full of kids. And do you want to know, the people at the studio were running from that movie. They thought, this is the worst movie that was ever made. And I will not in any way have my name attached to it. Well, we saw it in front of, you know, with a room full of kids, and the kids were laughing their heads off, and we thought, this guy's really funny, you know. And we called the guys at New Line and said, you ought to give him $1 million. You really ought to. This guy's, he's pretty good. They said, leave the business to us. The movie came out, was a big hit opening weekend, a surprise hit, at which point everyone came back, that's my movie, you know, I love that, I always loved it. And they called on Monday afternoon, we'll give you $1 million. He said, no. By then, he wanted, like, $2 million. No, I'm not giving you two. I'll give you, you know, and then they started over. Well, long story short, 2 weeks later, New Line signed him to do our movie for $7 million because he had just been auctioned around. Everybody wanted a piece of him. And then all of a sudden, the movie, you know, because they're giving him seven, our budget went up to 16. We got a lot more money to shoot it. We got more time. We got more days. We got better locations. And you know, they gave us $16 million, which was... You know, so for us, it was a lot of, you know,
and
luck
somehow,
just being in the right
during
place.
During this whole period, they failed to, again, ask, like, well, what have you directed? Like, they kind of had forgotten about us because...
Nobody ever asked.
No, they never asked. They just never asked. And in fact, we had a backup plan. I'd called a friend of mine who was at UCLA Film School. I said, yeah, can you get me a reel or something in case they ask? I'll show them something. But they never did.
It got to the point where the night before or 2 days before they were ready to make this movie, what happened, Pete?
Well, the night before, we finally, we went up to, we started shooting in Breckenridge, Colorado, which is at 9,600 feet. It's very high. And it was, I couldn't breathe up there. You know, the altitude with the pressure of, you know, what is going on here? You know, we're going to direct a major motion picture. And we don't know what the hell we're doing. And I just had a panic attack of panic attacks. You know, I was like curled up on a bed, just like, you know, blubbering. And Bobby was like saying, just calm down. Just, we've gone this far. Just calm down. I was like, no, you don't get it. We don't know what we're doing. Are you a moron? How do we show up? When do we yell action? You tell me when. There's like 9 things said before that, you know, speed lights. Is, when do we yell it? So we called David Zucker, who we'd written a script for before, and, you know, he wasn't, you know, he's no, you know, brain surgeon either, and he'd made a movie. So we called him, and we were like, David, how the hell, what do we have to know? You know, he was from Milwaukee. He came out, made a movie. He hadn't gone to film school. He says, you don't have to know anything, but you got to be honest with everybody. He says, it's, if you know the story and you know what you want and you trust the guys around you and you don't try to be Mr. Know-It-All, it'll work out. But you have to tell them. He's like, he said, you got to tell them. First thing you got to do is you got to get the DP and tell them. I said, what's the DP? He's like, director of photography. I was like, yeah, what's that? He's like, you know, the main camera guy. And then he said, and get the first AD. He's like, I don't know what that is. He's like, the guy's like been running things, yelling at people. Okay. And we basically got them and we were honest with them and told them and say, listen, we don't know what the hell we're doing. We're salesmen. This is, you know, we're lost here. And they kind of, you know, walked us through it. The first day, I remember, the first AD would, you know, yell like, you know, speed, this, that, and then he'd point to us and we'd, action! And we were off to the races.
We're listening to the Farrelly brothers who wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary. They were interviewed by filmmaker Michael Corenti at the New York Comedy Film Festival. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the Farrelly brothers who made the films Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. They were interviewed by fellow filmmaker Michael Corenti at the New York Comedy Film Festival.
When all of these comedies, when so many comedies out there put on the screen and fail, what do you think it is about the pictures that you guys make that succeed? You've had 3 very successful films when there have been so many, I mean, scores of comedies. To have 3 films work as well as they have in a row, what do you think it is that separates the stuff you guys do from these other comedies?
Well, you know, our feeling is, and you know, not in, and by the way, you know, there's a million good comedy writers out there, and, you know, we read scripts a lot of times that are very, very funny, but they don't work as movies because, you know, people think when we start a movie, we're sitting down like, how can we beat that? You know, what can we do that's more gross? You know, and that isn't how we approach it. The first thing we do is we think, how can we make a character so likable that you could get away with murder? And that's what we do. We have to make, set up a guy. Like, even in Dumb and Dumber, the most important scene in that movie to us is before they go on the trip to look for Mary, you know, Jim's in his apartment, he's looking out the window, and he says, you know, I don't have anything, I don't have anyone. And he actually worked up a little tear in his eye. And when the studio saw that, they said, what is that? This is a comedy. Get rid of that. And we're like, no, you can't get rid of that, that's crucial. Because in the very next scene, he's selling a dead bird to a blind kid in a wheelchair. You're like, if you don't love this guy, it's over at that point. They're going to hate him. So they kept fighting us. Finally, they said, listen, please do us a favor. Just test it. Test it without that scene. Like, okay, we'll test it. So we did a test screen. It came out. And you could just feel it in the audience. It just... they didn't like these guys, and they were just creepy, you know. And I remember we came out in the lobby afterwards. We felt like, oh, thank God, it didn't, because we were afraid for some reason it would go well. We really wanted that scene, and it didn't go well. But the guys came walking out. They said, that was the best screening yet. And we were looking like, you got to be kidding. They're like, no, it's the best. But luckily, the scores came in. They dropped 20 points. And they allowed us to put it back. Well, that's how we start everything. Like Ben Stiller, you know, if you don't love Ben Stiller in this movie in the first 20 minutes, and we went out of our way to make sure you did, then at the end when he has the thing on his ear, man, that is not going to be funny. That's just going to be gross. And so that is how we approach it. And I think a lot of movies don't. Like my favorite comedies do. Like I love the movie Tommy Boy. I thought that was a great, great comedy. And the reason it is because you really cared about Farley in that movie. He was a likable, you know, schlump. And he had a couple of moments where he talked about his dad or, you know, he got a little misty and you cared about him as opposed to a lot of these comedies where you just, if you don't like the guy, they just come across mean-spirited, as would ours if we hadn't taken the time to set him up.
Yeah, and to that, I would like to add that with a comedy, and probably with every movie, but we've only done comedy so far, you know, you go and you test the movie. The studio takes it and they show it to a 500 or 600 people in some town in New Jersey or out in Sherman Oaks, California. And then they make everyone fill out cards and telling you what, you know, asking what they like and what they don't like about the movie. And to me, that's like the most predictable thing in the world is that beyond that, then they keep 20 people in a focus group at the end of the, everyone else leaves, and they keep the 20 people, and they sit up there in the front of the room, and they ask them, what did you like, what didn't you like, how was the music, how was this, how was that? And within those 20 people, there's like two or three people, it's the dynamics of any group that like to hear themselves talk, they get up, they have a lot to say, it doesn't make them great movie makers. But if that kid says, he should get the girl at the end, and there's eight studio heads back there, well, you're going to have a hell of a time fighting them that your hero doesn't get the girl at the end. And so what it comes down to is there's some 13-year-old kid in the Valley who's calling the shot on every movie coming out of Hollywood. And fortunately with Pete and I, is like, I really do think because it was two of us that, and we were stubborn enough, was like, no, they don't get that. You won't believe how many times they tried to get us at the end of Dumb and Dumber to get that the two guys, you know, make out with two girls and that's a happy end, you know. And so finally, when we did the thing at the end where the bikini girls come up and all that, and it was the big issue was the guys have to get on the bus, you know? It was like, they're dumb and they're dumber. They don't get on the bus. They never would. They never will. We'd be selling out if they get on the bus. The kid in the front said he wanted them to get on the bus. I'm like, no, he doesn't get on the bus. And I don't know how we
so you're saying the kid's wrong. Like, you heard him. Why would he lie? You know, you're like, he's not lying. It's just it's programmed into him to want that. Like how many people want him to get on the bus? The whole place. Everybody lifts their arm. Yeah, it's happy. That's nice. But that's not what we do. And now today, people approach like, thank God they didn't get on that bus. You know, that would have been horrible.
Okay. One last question. What is it about Rhode Island that we all think is so funny?
Every time I tell Rhode Island stories, rather than laughing, people just feel, I get a look of horror because it is a twisted place. You know, it's a great place. I mean, I love it. You know, we're from there and we had a great time, but I don't know. It's something about, maybe it's everywhere. You know, maybe it's not just Rhode Island, but that's all we're writing about. But we happen to have, I remember when our friends were leaving, this is like one of those, it's to us is like, one of those stories stuck with us. It's a horrifying story, but our best friend was moving to South Carolina, you know, in 1970, and the whole family was going. The father got a transfer. It was very sad, and the kids were pissed about going. They were about to start high school, a couple of them, and nobody wanted to go, but, you know, the father got the transfer, and they had a dog, Tippy, who was like, you know, this was back in the days when, you know, dogs ran everywhere. You know, you see him like, oh, there's Tippy. He'd be 3 miles from home, you know, just be running down the street. Oh, there he goes, you know. You'd be playing football and like a pack of dogs would come through. Okay, hold on, wait up. You know, the dogs would be, and then go on. You know, they've got things to do. And Tippy, the kids felt that it would be not fair to take Tippy, who was, I think, 8 or 9 at the time, to South Carolina because he had so much freedom there. And they were discussing whether to give him to the neighbors or to take him. Half the kids wanted to take him, half wanted to give him to the neighbor. And they started screaming back and forth. There were 4 or 5 kids. And while they were doing this, all of a sudden they heard a gunshot, and they went out back, and the father had shot Tippy. And he said,
I'll fix
the argument's over.
Exactly. That's Rhode Island.
And that's Rhode Island to me. It's like, it's very odd.
We're listening to the Farrelly brothers, who wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary. They were interviewed by Michael Corenti at the New York Comedy Film Festival. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of Peter and Bobby Farrelly, the duo that wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. We recorded them in October at the New York Comedy Film Festival, where they were interviewed on stage by filmmaker Michael Corenti. In the question and answer period, someone in the audience asked about the Farrelly's brand of humor.
Subtle humor to us is like, not funny. you know, we like to go all the way for it. Like, we feel like, I'll give you an example. David Zucker sent me a script about a year ago, and it was called Toddlers, which is going to get made. It hasn't been made yet. And the idea is these two guys, they crash land in somewhere in the Himalayas, and it's a valley of giants. And in that valley, there's all tall people, and they hate short people. They kill them as soon as they get anywhere near there. They realize this early on, so they shave their body hair, and they wrap themselves in blankets and drop themselves off in an orphanage. And they are toddlers. And, you know, they, to protect themselves. And they start liking it because the nurses come in every day and give them a bath. And the nurses, like, scrub them, like, oh, you're a big boy, you know? And they really look forward to it. And one day the nurses come in, they're like, hey, they throw off their clothes, like, you know, here's a bath, you know? And the nurse pulls him into the other room, and there's some religious figure there with a knife or scissors, and there's going to be what you think is a circumcision. And they're like, no, they're trying to run away, and they yank him over, and the scissors come down, and they cut the hair of each, a little lock of hair. It's a tradition in the tall people world. And I read the script. I called David. I said, David, that's the 80s. That's like you're saying, like, oh, I thought. Well, the way we do it is, like, I say circumcise them. Circumcise them and have them limping around for 10 minutes in the movie and let it get infected. Go further. Like, let something worse happen than that. That's how they always did movies in the 80s. Like, oh, I thought he was going to end up sleeping with his mother. No, sleep with your mother by mistake. You know, go there. Go all the way. And, like, the subtleties are lost on us.
No, but what we do, you know, maybe we're dead wrong, or what we think we do, is that what's subtle is that, like, in Something About Mary, there is a romantic comedy and there a love story. Like, that's subtle. Is it, and in a way, it's kind of camouflaged by these big gags that everyone else talks about. But take those away, and there's another movie. You know, and so that maybe that, I mean, I consider that subtle, that's in there, too. And that's what makes the gags work better. If there was no other story, if there was no other layer to it, the jokes wouldn't work as well.
Another question from the audience was about the Farrelly's working methods. Their interviewer and fellow film director, Michael Corenti, spoke first.
Well, I grew up in the construction business. I get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock every morning. They don't. So I was sitting on the edge of my bed the first day we started writing, like 5 o'clock, 6:30. I figured I'll give them till 7:30, 8 o'clock. About 1:30, Pete gets up and goes, time for lunch. I say, lunch. Okay. I'm trying to be nice. So we eat lunch. Bobby comes over. They read the paper. Now it's about 2:30. 2:30 in the afternoon. I'm sitting there scratching my head. Bobby says, so, you ready? I say, yeah, I'm ready. So we write for about an hour. Pete says, God, I'm exhausted. I got to take a walk. So we take a walk. Put the Andy Griffith comes on at 4. We got to watch that. About 6:30, Pete says, well, that was a great day, don't you think?
You know, there was a Seinfeld episode where they try to write their sitcom. I don't know if you remember, but where they're basically sitting on the couch reading. And, you know, that was the funniest one to us because it is so true. We really... we'll take about, when we start a script, we'll take a week or two where literally we'll not even make an effort. We'll just be reading and talking and getting all the crap out of the way that you do. And then finally somebody's like, this is, you know, this is embarrassing. Like, he has to go home, he has to face his kids, you know, like, Daddy, you work? You know, we're sitting in our underwear watching the Masters or something, you know? So eventually we get down to it. And once we do get down to it, we work pretty hard for about...
15, 20 minutes?
No, we'll never, I mean, we never really work, I don't think we work often more than 4 hours a day, I mean, actually writing. Because, you know, at that point, it's, I mean, that's a lot of time to write, you know, it's, don't you think?
Well, I have to say, when I write by myself, and I write from the crack of dawn until 6 or 7 at night, but the fact of the matter is, you get about 4 hours of good work a day, regardless of whether you sit there and beat yourself over the head for 12 hours. You really get about 4 hours of work a day. They just, and I learned a lot about writing working with these guys. I learned a lot about patience. I learned a lot about not forcing the joke. That you really do have to take the time to let it develop, or you have material, comedy-wise, that's forced, and it ends up looking like that.
Yeah, and another thing that we do, by the way, talking about that, is like, occasionally someone will have an idea that, you know, if you expect an idea to be funny right off the bat, forget it. It doesn't happen. Like, and a lot of people dismiss it, and nah, that's not, and we don't. We say, like, someone has something, we say, well, wait a second, hold on now, wait. Don't lock that out. Wait a second. There's something there. Mm-hmm. And we toss it around and look in every angle, and, you know, 4 to 5 times, there isn't anything there. It's like, okay, that didn't go anywhere. But we'll look. We'll milk it. We'll mine it. You go in, look all the ways around. Is there a way to come back? And then, you know, because people expect it just to be funny right away, and it's not. It's about timing, and, you know, it's very complicated.
It's work. It's not as easy. I mean, we joke and laugh. We sit around and watch the TV, but it's work. That kind of comedy. Yeah,
and when you're sitting around joking and watching the TV, it's generally because you're not quite sure what you're supposed to be doing, you know, and that needs time to be thought through and get right. Once it's right, then we can bang out a bunch of pages in a row, but it doesn't even make sense if you don't have it to just get the pages down, just to get them down. Like, I mean, we force ourselves to get pages down, but it's okay to sit around and just talk about things. Generally, there's a reason why you're not writing is because you need to think it through more. Which is also why in the world of comedy, it's almost a total necessity that you write with a partner. It may not be so in other genres, but in comedy, you need two guys egging each other on and bringing each other further. I think rare is the person that can go find those places by
Woody
himself.
Woody Allen, Neil
yeah,
Simon.
I know. They did do it for sure, but those guys are like, you know, legends.
The Farrelly Brothers recorded at the New York Comedy Film Festival, where they were interviewed by their old friend and fellow film director Michael Corenti.